Hi folks, what's up? This is the Train Smart, Move Well podcast, where everything is really about training and movement. In this podcast, I deliver what I call input sessions, where I just talk by myself about anything that is related to these two themes, training and movement, and I do my best to provide you with value. Snackable advice for your training, things that you can use out there in the real world. I give you perspectives, I share mindsets with you that are worth being exposed to, and many more things. Alongside this, so next to the input sessions, I also have regularly guests that I talk to. These people can be professional athletes. These people can be coaches and literally anyone that inspires me and that I think can bring value to my listeners, to you guys, and can bring something to the table. And we want to talk about training and give you advice. And this is also the topic today. Today, my guest is Gunnar Grasbeck from Finland. Gunnar is a PhD student in social sciences who's enrolled at the German Sports University of Cologne, so Deutsche Sporthochschule Köln, and he does fencing. So in this episode, we will give both an insight into this discipline for the first half, and in the second half, Gunnar and I will talk about his current research project. My name is Philip Jacobs, and right after the intro, we will get going. Gunnar, what's up, man?
Yeah, I'm good. And you?
Thanks. I'm great, too. It's a pleasure to have you here on this podcast. And for the first time, we just talked about it in our little introduction talk. It is in English. So it's your first podcast overall. It's my first podcast in the English language. So I'm just going to say apologies out there to all the native speakers for my German sausage accent. I hope it will. You can bear with me and with us. Gunnar, I usually do this with all my guests. Also, when I speak with them in German, I ask them the questions. Yeah. Who are you? What are you doing? And what have you been up to lately? So just in a bunch of sentences, give us a quick introduction as to who you are.
Yeah, well, who I am. I am who I am. No, just kidding. My name is Gunnar Grasbeck. I am 29 years old. I was born in Helsinki in 93 in a cold January day. And I'm actually born in a bilingual family. Like, okay. I have spoken both Swedish and Finnish in my household. So I got, in one way, two languages for free, which I am really thankful for, because
that's amazing.
Later on, I managed actually to get my whole sports education in Sweden, because it was honestly easier to apply there compared to Finland, because they have more possibilities for sport. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. That's a bit about me. And what do I do? Yeah, I am a graduated teacher in physical education from Sweden. And based on my current situation, yeah, sadly, I don't work as a teacher. But I did, during my exchange year at the Sport University in Cologne, which is like one of the most acclaimed sport universities in the world. And when I saw it the first time with my own eyes, it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I had the luck of getting to know the right people. And because of the connections I made, I am doing a PhD there today. And to just add one more thing, yes. Ever since I started to, when I enrolled to the academic world, I had always decided, no, I will finish. This is the degree I will do. Like nothing else after I finish my teacher's education and nothing more. But if I get a chance to make a PhD of the passion of my life, fencing, then okay, I will give it 100% and I want to do it if I get the chance. And I didn't believe it was honestly possible until I came to Spoho, or the sport university in Cologne, where I got the chance. And because that was in one way my technically a dream that I didn't believe was possible. And that's why I always had denied it. Like, no, I will never do it. But when I got the chance, now I'm doing it. So
this is absolutely amazing, mate. You exceeded the two sentences, though. But this is pretty interesting. A lot of things that I didn't even know about. I mean, just to give our listeners some background, we bump into each other every now and then in Leverkusen when I train the basketball players of the Bayer Giants Leverkusen, and then you are also doing your workout and preparing for fencing and so on and so forth. And we've had a few exchanges every now and then, but like, for example, that you were raised bilingually, that you can speak both Swedish and Finnish, English as well, is an amazing gift. That's perfect, especially with Finnish. I've never really tried. I just know it, and people say it's one of the toughest languages that you can ever try to learn. Isn't that right?
Like,
you have so many different grammatical clauses, even crazier than us German people. Isn't that so?
It's true, but I think like both Finnish and German are quite comparable. Like they are quite the same. That the languages have their charm. Yeah. For example, I can already give one example that is even widely known from Finnish. A word called kalsarikännit. It is one word for staying home in your underwear and drinking yourself wasted without any intention of going out to party.
Oh, that's absolutely amazing. Tell me the name
that's
again.
That's one word. Kalsarikännit.
Kalsarikännit. I probably butcher it. I'm sorry about that. I'm not even going to try anymore. But this sounds great.
Yeah, I can send you it in written form later. You can Google it and you can see memes about it. It's like incredible. Like Finland also has these words. Like I know German has also these words that you can't have in any other language, but it's like one word for a meaning. It's okay. Not even just, it's one word to describe a whole event.
It's crazy.
In Finnish,
yeah.
We also have this.
Loving it. Thank you for sharing this little trivia about about your language. Okay, man. Then before we dive into your discipline, into your sport, fencing, would you mind heading to the personal questions? You can feel free to shoot and start with that.
Oh, like personal questions? You mean I ask you or?
Yes, okay, you can start. I can also start. Whatever you feel fine.
Okay. Well, as a Finnish person, this is a very important question for me.
Okay.
Do you believe in Santa Claus?
If I believe in Santa Claus, I'm going to say no. Yeah, sorry, I don't.
Oh, yeah, because you do know he lives in the North Pole and mandatory to believe in him in Finland. He is from Finland originally and nothing is going to change that. And that's Finnish person's opinion.
So much trivia about your country, man, and we're only like 5 minutes into the podcast. We should change the topic and just make a presentation about your country. Okay, so another thing I didn't know. So Gunnar, let me ask you, what is the thing that you can laugh about out loud even when you're just by yourself?
Dark humor.
Nice.
Always. The darker, the more funny. And it's dangerous to even say here out loud to which levels I can laugh by myself.
Okay. Let's leave that for the next gym session where we meet each other. That's good. I like it. Cool, man. Is that another Finnish thing? Like the way that the Brits have a dark sense of humor, or is that just you personally?
I would say it's also a bit of a Finnish thing, but also maybe me personally. That's what I would say. a little bit of both.
Got you. Okay, let's try and act a bit more professional while we talk about your discipline. Let's go to fencing. This is what you do. Tell us a little bit about how you started. Has it been a thing you've been practicing from early on, like from your childhood? Is that something only you started doing during your lessons? And how did it develop from there until today?
Well, to be quite honest, it's basically been the guiding force of my life, to be really honest. I am not even close to be one of the best in the world, but I started fencing when I was 11. And it's, in my opinion, a bit of a cute story because I was overweight and I had never done any sports really seriously. But I was a hardcore nerd. I was playing a lot of video games. And then my mother said that, did you know that these characters with these big swords that they are using in these games, it's an Olympic sport? Oy. And tried to get me into sports this way. And I was like, really? I did not know. Yeah, and like if you are good at it, you can win medals and stuff. And as a kid, of course, I never had won a medal in anything yet because I didn't do sports. So I was like, oh, I can win medals by doing what I like to play with video games. So then my mother signed me up for a beginner's course. And yeah, I stayed with it. And let's put it this way. I'm also this person that I think that whatever you do, you should do it well or as good as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. So I started it and then I decided, okay, I will just do it. And then, well, it seemed I had some feeling for it. And I am happy about the coaches I had who like motivated me to become as good as I possibly could. And then, of course, no career is perfect, but at least in Finland with some ups and downs, I managed to reach a junior national team level. And then when I went to the first international competitions and got beaten thoroughly by international fencers, I already thought that no, like I need to get abroad one way or the other in order to become better. And but that's basically what even has motivated me to move to Germany in the first place. Like okay. I actually did the exchange to Spoho originally because I checked where's the best like fencing opportunities based on the exchange opportunities okay.
So
I had
it
in
wasn't
Sweden.
Even about the, it wasn't even about studying or the
no.
research or the PhD. You wanted to go in for the fencing, yeah?
Yeah, and then basically I narrowed the exchange semesters to two places. The sport uni in Budapest because Hungary is a very dominating fencing nation mm-hmm. or the Sporthochschule in Köln because I checked that the club in Leverkusen is like one of the best clubs in the country for epee fencing, which is my discipline. So but I knew also that because Hungary it's very traditional and it has like this very strict discipline that you basically, if you even mess up once in training, second chances are not given so often for foreigners. So then I have heard from many fencers who that Germany was like the most open-minded, like fencing nation or like a good fencing nation that was the most open-minded. So then I decided that yeah, let's go get there, let's give it a shot. And well, it turned out better than expected. I did not only get quite quickly accepted to the club, and for all the fencers who listen to this, you are amazing. And I also got my own new professional network. So turned out to be the best decision of my life.
That's
quite
absolutely
honestly.
Amazing, man. Awesome to hear. And I'm sensing a reoccurring theme here because earlier when we just talked in the beginning about you pursuing the PhD, even though in the beginning it wasn't even your intention. You said, okay, now I have the chance to do this and I'm going all in. Like, this is 100% what I want to do.
Yeah.
It sounds like you had a similar approach in terms of fencing, right? So your mom signed you up when you were still a kid, more being focused on playing games and a little overweight, as you said, but then you realized, hey, this is something I can actually excel in. Now I'm doing this 100%. And this is what got you to Germany and to pursue the fencing and so on and so forth. So that's quite interesting.
Thanks. And to add also one thing about fencing is that it's a very small sport. So mm-hmm. naturally, I always knew that I can't do it like a footballer, like put all my efforts only on that. And that's why it's also a bit complicated. Like I have basically my whole life had to always prioritize with many parameters of life. Like, yes, I would want to be this Olympic champion, the greatest in the world, but yes, I can put even tens of years into this and, well, waste many great professional opportunities as well. So it's a really hard discipline in a way that even during the past, like, for example, I can just give an example. Even the greatest fencer, in my opinion, who ever lived, Pavel Kolobkov from Russia, like he's a four-time world champion. And even despite training 20, 30 hours a week, he managed to get a dual master's degree from a uni and even managed to like gym companies at the same time.
All right.
So it was like also my inspiration that it's not only sports, it's like the greatest fencers in the world, how I see it, are like these real tactical masterminds who are also physical machines.
I see.
So that was like my inspiration, basically.
Yes. That sounds like an awesome vision. You must know that the people that are listening to this podcast, they're hopefully also a lot of fencers. Hi, you guys. It's great you're here. But a lot of them are also not fencers, like myself. So let us try and give a little bit of an overview of an introduction to the people who know, okay, there is something called fencing. And yes, it's two people with some pointy sticks in their hands. But what is this discipline really about? I mean, we know they're wearing these white robes and they have this mask on. But tell us a bit, how does it work for the people that have never even seen a whole duel or a match or however you would call it in the English language and terminology?
I try to keep it as simple as possible.
Please tell me. I'll give you 5 minutes, Gunnar. Yes.
Yeah, please tell me if you don't understand, because that's like also a thing with fencing. Like you say, it's quite hard to understand what's going on if you are not a fencer yourself. So please tell me if it's still a bit dizzy after my explanation. But basically,
I'll do my best to interrupt you every now and then. But go ahead. Let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Like basically, yeah, like modern fencing as an Olympic sport, it's divided into, to start off with, it's divided into three disciplines: the saber, the foil, and the épée. And they all three have different rules. So I am gonna need a whole podcast just to explain the rules of each and one of them. But because my discipline is épée, I will only focus on that one.
We'll stick to that. How is the, do you know the German term for this, épée?
Degen.
Degenfechten. Degenfechten. Got you. Perfect. Okay,
yeah,
let's
in
continue.
German. Yeah, so like in épée, it's also the most simple to follow. It's the classic dueling weapon. You hit the opponent, you score a point, or sometimes a touch, as we say. And because in the old times, even when both score each other at the same time, then both died. So then you, even today, both are awarded a hit or a point if like both score each other simultaneously. And by a score, I mean that in modern fencing, no, we are not having these sharp weapons anymore. We have,
you don't cut each other? That's so boring.
No. People are not dying anymore. Like, we are not living in the Roman gladiator age.
So
sadly.
Much excitement is gone now.
Yeah.
Where's the thrill, Gunnar? Okay, but this is interesting. So you're saying even when you touch each, when you have a touch on both sides, so you you stick me with your pointy end, I stick you with the pointy end of my Degen, then we both are being awarded a point. I always thought that there is like a system that is measuring by the split second who hit first, and then only that person gets the point. That's how I imagined it.
I can understand that. And in one way, like that's how they even try to keep it in the other two disciplines, because there you can't get dual hits like at the same time. They have like different priorities, who attacked first and who parried and all this, that the referee has to really, like the judge of the bout really has to pay attention to in order to award the point correctly. But in Degenfechten, like épée fencing, it's much more simple. You hit and you score. And the whole body is target area. Like you can hit the foot, you can hit the knee, you can even aim at the backhand that is like up above the head of the fencer behind, if you are super precise, but it's incredibly difficult.
Okay. And also the face is allowed. Yeah. You can
even
hit
the face. Yeah. Where the mask is protecting you, you are also allowed to hit that. So feel free to find your own optimal solution to hit the target however you can at the best of your capacity. And gotcha. That's what I think in EPE is actually also the most interesting, because it is the easiest to follow, but in my opinion, it's the most difficult to master. Because in foil and saber, there are like some parameters that are easier to control, because you know that you have the right of way with the priority. Like if you are a very aggressive and you know the opponent's defense is bad, you know that most likely you are going to win, because it's a game that favors the aggressor sometimes. But EPE, like everything is allowed. You're like, really, it's like about... everything is allowed according to the rules. That, of course, no, you are not allowed to use your fist and hit the guy on the head and then stab him and get a point. No. But like, you are free to like use everything in your capacity to outsmart your opponent and hit him on the foot, on the chest, or anywhere. And he's trying to do the same to you, or yeah, she.
So it can be a really, really chaotic scenario, because there's like total freedom in terms of how you attack and have to defend yourself likewise. So how do we start? So there's two guys standing in front of each other. What happens?
We are taught the rules of how to greet your opponent. Like it's still considered a gentleman's sport today. So like you are staying there with your... straight legs with the mask on your other arm, and you put your weapon arm first down, and then you lift it up and show it against your opponent to greet him. And then to the referee, to the Kampfrichter of Deutsch, and then down again. And then you put the mask on and you take the en garde position, which means like the fencing position that you are ready to fight. And then you wait for the referee to give the signal when to begin. So the referee is going to ask you, are you ready? And then after this, when there's either no answer, or some very old-fashioned fencers would say yes, like they are like we, like in French, like uh-huh. they are ready, then they say start. Uh-huh. And in international tournaments, they have to do all the refereeing in French, like, or in English, but at least like these, for example, en garde, est vous prêt? Allez. It means like, en garde, are you ready? Or like, be prepared. And then, est vous prêt means, are you ready? And then, allez means start.
Go.
Yeah. And then you are free to start, and they put the timer on with the clock, it's ticking. And then they do this until there's a hit, or until the referee interrupts, because there are some other rule sets, like if you step outside the fencing strip, then you are punished by moving 1 meter behind, or there are always these rule sets as well. But otherwise, yeah, then it's freedom to do as you please, to try to hit the other guy.
Yeah. Or, so you're talking about this fencing strip. So it's like, it's basically you can... more or less go forward or backward, right? There's not so much space for lateral movement. So you either attack or you defend it by taking a step back. Then you just mentioned that there's this clock. What's this about? Is it similar to, say, in basketball, there's the 24-second shot clock? So within those 24 seconds, you have to shoot and make that point. Otherwise, you will lose the ball. Is that similar as to fencing? Do you have like a time limit and until when you have to score or make a move?
That's actually a really interesting point of view, how you even compare basketball to this. This is something I will pay attention to even in my PhD now. That it doesn't exist in the pre-rounds, because the fencing competition is also divided into the pre-round and then the direct elimination. Okay. And to put it as simple as possible, like in the direct elimination, the matches are longer, and then you have only 1 minute time to score a hit. If you don't, the losing fencer, who has less points than the opponent, gets punished with a warning. And if you get another warning, like after 1 minute again without no score, you get punished with another warning and two warnings. It's like, then you get like a real punishment, and it's like one hit 1 point to the opponent.
Okay, so does that mean you have 1 minute for the whole elimination game, the pregame, or just 1 minute per bout or per set?
Like per set, I would say. Like if the referee says like this, en garde, et vous prêt, allez. From there, if there's no hit or no other means of interruption, then like, and you don't score a hit, like then you get a warning. And if it's equal, like no points are yet given, both fencers get a warning.
Gotcha.
And this is actually, it's quite recently changed because they call this rule set non-combativity. Because it's a combat sport, it's expected that you combat and try to find means of defeating your opponent. Exactly. So if you don't score any hits, then it's a sign of non-combat, will of fight, no will of fighting. And then you, of course, get punished for that. But they even changed this rule set now, quite recently. I think they still didn't have this properly. Now, excuse me if I remember wrong, but I think they started really change this a bit before Rio Olympics, or was it after that? Like, you can only get this warning four times as a losing fencer. And if you get it the fourth time, you get disqualified
then
from the fight.
Got you.
You're out. Okay. Like,
so
you lost.
How many rounds do you do? How many rounds or sets of these 1 minutes do you do until the pre-match, the pre-duel is done before you go into the deciding thing?
Yes. So like in a, let's take a competition with all about a World Cup environment in the international field. Like there are 300 fencers. They are big, the tournaments. And they all fencers are divided into pools, how we call them, like rounds of 6 to 7 fencers.
Yeah.
And the pre-round, the preliminary rounds, is where all these fencers in these 6 to 7 fencer pools, they fight against each other for 5 hits. And here, it's only 1 fight to 3 minutes. And either you fight until the time runs out or until 5 hits are done by one fencer.
Yeah.
And these are like still quite basic. In the direct elimination rounds where these rules of non-combativity start, then you fence to 15 points or 3 times 3 minutes. And then you have a 1 minute break between each period. And it's in these fights where you can get this 1 minute warning only 4 times, then you're out if you're the losing fencer.
Okay, I'm beginning to understand the system now. Gotcha. So there's the preliminary round, hit of 5, and then you go to the deciding rounds, 15 points or 3 times 3 minutes. And then what happens then? Then the people from the pool, the top people that win, they go to the next round, or how does it work?
Yeah, it works like in the big tournaments that usually from the preliminary rounds, they disqualify around 30%. So let's say from your 6 bouts, sometimes if you even win 2 out of 6, it's not enough to qualify, because they also have this index of how many hits or points you did and how many you received. So to be on the safe side, you need to win half. Then you are certainly qualified to the direct elimination rounds. And then it's like tableau, like this cup tableau, like
KO system, tennis, basically.
Yeah. KO system, exactly. Like it's first, like in these big tournaments, it starts with 256, then 128, then 64, and it goes like that until there's a winner.
Gotcha.
And that's how it continues with the direct elimination fights.
And this is the fights, just to clarify this again, in the direct elimination fights, you have the duel for 15 points or 3 times 3 minutes. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Got you. Okay. Boy, that can take a long day, right? When there's 300 fencers.
That's the problem. And that's why like fencing is like
the problem.
1 day can take, especially with technical problems or some other stupid things happening in a competitive environment. It's so dynamical and nonlinear. Like I think the longest day ever like that I have had was that we started fencing 8 in the morning and finished 11 p.m. in the evening.
Jesus.
15 hours. all day in one day. It's like must be the longest that I have ever done.
Oh,
and and you need to keep yourself ready and fit, and you can't just take a nap and sleep too long, because then if they say, hey, you get a call, you need to fight. Oh, damn it, I'm not ready. Then it's basically a battlefield, like in the old times, that you are out there and you try to survive in one way.
Yeah, this is freaking mental. I mean, from one moment to the other, after having waited for 1.5 hours or whatsoever, you just got to be ready for the point, and then it's just 9 minutes maximum, and then you're out again, having to wait for another hour or so.
It can happen.
So very, very also cognitively tough, isn't it?
Yes, for certain.
Yeah. You used the word nonlinear, and I would like to use that as an introduction or as a transition to your research, which is about nonlinear pedagogy. How do you even pronounce that in English?
It's so funny, because that was even my intention.
Hey, let's get to it.
Like nonlinear pedagogy.
Pedagogy
in English.
Yes. Pedagogy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we know you are doing your PhD research. Nobody probably knows what your topic is about. I know that it is somewhat related to the constraints-led approach. So let us give our listeners a brief and soft intro what this is all about before we go into the nasty bits and a bit more nerdy about the specific theories. Can you give us some insight?
I really try to keep this one even more simple, because I read about these things daily, and please also tell me if this was too confusing.
Yeah,
but
let's go.
To put it really simply, well, first you need to think, what is linear pedagogy, like linear teaching. It means that you basically have a one size fits for all approach to coaching. You follow all methods that have worked in the past the best way possible, and because it worked the best in the past, you are using it even today, because you don't want to risk doing something else that will be counterproductive to performance. However, nonlinear pedagogy has showed, in combination with other research within motor learning, that in fact, learning is nonlinear always, no matter how you do it. We are all different. We are all different individuals. We are all having our own characteristics, and applying one method on a can't work ever the same way if you apply the same method to someone else. So by accepting this dynamical system, that we are all actually dynamical systems as human beings learning differently, the nonlinear pedagogy with the support of this is a more preferable way. And it's not yet been, so it's just the opposite of linear teaching, that you acknowledge the learner as an individual, and you try to like apply individual based learning through variative exercises that the individuals can learn in their own way.
This is really interesting. Yeah, it's and now we're getting to the geeky part, but that's also part of this episode.
Exactly.
It's really reminding me of what I've been reading a lot about during my master's in England, when I was studying strength and conditioning at St. Mary's University, and there was one module where it was about skill acquisition, and now you're using, you know, dynamic system. Then what you talked about, this nonlinear approach and that people learn differently, really reminded me of the skill acquisition phases, and it reminded me of contextual interference and all these things. Maybe we're even going to talk a little bit about that, and something that's part of your research. So that's it's ringing some bells. I'm looking forward to get deeper into this.
Definitely, I can already say skill acquisition is very closely related to nonlinear pedagogy. And you mentioned contextual interference. I have also read about it, but I don't recall completely what it was. So I am also looking forward to discuss this more deeply, where we can share the infos, what we know about our own topics.
Yes,
basically.
Man, sounds great. So but should we dive deeper into your current approach? So you are saying there's the linear, there's the nonlinear approach. What I'm now interested in is figuring out how to use this nonlinear approach in the field of fencing. So how do we build the bridge now to what you're doing in your research at the moment?
Well, like fencing, like even I said, like it's from the competitive perspective, it is extremely dynamic. Like you can't say how a competition is really gonna go before it has happened. So because this is the reality, I think the nonlinear way of teaching is really the approach, because the competition already alone is a nonlinear dynamic environment. But the thing is, after everything I have read, like even to this day, like I'm not saying every single one, but almost all fencing literature are only portraying different fencing techniques and how to do them correctly. And they all say it the same way, regardless if the author was French or German or Hungarian, they explain the same thing over and over again, emphasizing no individuality, really, or very little, at least.
It has to and be then, done, because that's how we used to do it for all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I actually, at the same time, I can understand it, because I just recently read about it, actually, that like, yeah, like if you think about it in the past, I mean, you died if you went to fight in the field of battle with swords. So to learn through a linear sequential system, it was mandatory, because you don't want anyone to just go out there with a sword without any clue how to use it and die because of incompetence.
True, from a historical point of view, that makes exactly perfect sense, right? Because you literally were dying or not dying, protecting yourself. Exactly. So it was by no means a time to try something new for the sake of just trying something new. But this is different. We're exactly in a safe environment now.
Yeah, exactly. And like you, and that's actually, when you mentioned safety, that's in fact what fencing has been trying to do. Most fencing research has been trying to actually make the sport safer, like put a lot of emphasis on equipment and make them as durable and safe as possible. And today I would say that because of that progress, fencing is even, I would even dare say, it's today more safe than ice hockey and football. There are less injuries in fencing compared to many other sports in the world. So they have done a good job about that. And but yeah, like it's a modern, it's still not, however, modernized. Like there's no longer the pointy end. So you are free to do this exploratory learning, which they do in all other sports, yeah, but they still don't do it in the same manner in fencing, that they offer the space of trial and error in training. But it's more like this, coach is the master and he knows everything, or she knows everything, and you need to do everything that the coach tells you to do and become this manipulative puppet that the coach uses in a competition and tells what to do. Like, I'm not saying everyone is doing that, but most are doing it even to this day, based on my own empirical experience.
Okay, and now this, it seems like it's a bit your mission to go a bit against that and just help people opening up their eyes and maybe explore their horizons a bit. So let us get into your actual approach in your research. What are you investigating?
Well, after everything I have learned and what I have learned read so far, and this can naturally change. It's a non-linear path to enlightenment as a researcher. But in skill acquisition, like you also mentioned, there's this really famous constraints-led approach model that they use for applying skill teaching through variation into practice. And this is done by basically recognizing and portraying all parameters that are measurable and able to be manipulated as constraints by definition within each sport context. Yeah. And this was the start of all nonlinear pedagogical application for the sports where they have done most about this, for example, football, track and field, golf, and field hockey to some extent. They always started by portraying this model to offer coaches, or as in the literature, practitioners, can by manipulating the constraints correctly, always guide the learner according to the learner's own needs in order to reach a certain performance outcome.
Yes.
And this was to me like the biggest, like, wow, like light bulb moment, like to define these parameters, everything, including like, I don't know, the moistness of the air in a fencing competition environment. It really piqued my interest to try to portray all of these by creating a CLA model, like a constraint-led approach model for fencing specifically, that this would be the optimal start. So that any practitioner, regardless of their like background, they can just see, oh, these are the existent parameters of fencing. Can I manipulate them, like time, distance to the opponent, temperature of the training hall, light? If I can just manipulate this correctly according to the individual's needs, the individual will always learn.
Mm.
So this is basically what my first article is about, to have a very strong theoretical framework for this fencing CLA model, and then also prove its representativeness through representative learning design. And with the theoretical framework for that, that this constraint manipulation in training will not only work in training, but the skills that they learn through the constraint manipulation and acquire new skills, they also will become transferable to the desired performance environment.
Yes, let that sink in, dear listeners. It's a lot of information. So let's try and zoom out. Let's try and zoom out a bit, because I mean, we use these words, the constraint-led approach, a bunch of times now, and maybe we zoom out a bit and just give a broad overview.
Of course,
the way that I learned it during my master's is that there's three overall like categories, let's call them headlines or whatsoever. So those three subcategories that can be manipulated, which is the task, the environment, and the individual, basically. This is how I remind it. And you already named some of the things, some variables, such as the temperature in the fencing hall, which would belong to the environment. But then you can also manipulate the individual so that, say, your opponent on the other end of the fencing court, sorry for using the wrong word here, the fencing stripe, or how is it?
The fencing strip.
The fencing strip. So the opponent on the other end of the fencing strip would only use this technique now, or that technique. So thereby I'm like manipulating the individual in front of you, or I can manipulate the task and say, hey, I'm not going to allow you to attack the upper body anymore. You're only going for the lower extremities, that is legs and knees and ankles and whatsoever. So this is just like my brief view on how we can look at constraints-led approach, the overall like head categories in which sub thingies belong to it. Is there, would you like to add something? What's your opinion about this?
I actually think you already brought like the thing that still for me is the most interesting point, like how to actually manipulate the individual in training. Like based on what I have now found, I don't think direct individual manipulation is ever possible, because you always need some kind of manipulation of the task or the environment to also make a change in the individual behavior. To just make it simply like you change something from the individual, like nothing, it always usually happens based on something that happens with the task or the environment. That's something that there's still nothing that has shown, based on what I have found, that you can just make a change like that. For example, something that I already am finding is like, for example, manipulate an intrinsic quality like concentration or target of focus. If you, for example, focus only on the hand of the opponent, it will limit your vision of the whole body, because the hand is more forward and you are only focusing on that. So you are limiting the other possibilities that you can see. But if you focus, for example, on the chest, then you see all the other possibilities, and you also see the distance properly and how to execute movements.
So the peripheral vision is just much more valuable for you in that sense, because you see so much more movements. This reminds me actually of the times when I used to do some martial arts and some boxing, where it was also like, so let's just put martial arts as an example. When in stand-up fighting, your opponent could hit you with their fists. They could strike this way, but they could also kick you, and you can't just focus only on the legs or only on the fists. So you have to somehow look around the chest, and then you see, okay, what might that person do now?
Same idea.
Yeah.
Identical.
Similar. And then also when you said, when you use different, types of focus, to give another example, for the weight room, so like my living room, so to speak, there's the internal and external focus, right? So I could ask a person to jump on the box, on a box, like a 40 centimeter box, to jump on it, and I say, as quickly as you can, triple extend in your ankles and knees and hips, and I give more like a kinematic biomechanical explanation as to what they should be doing. Or I could tell them, jump as high as you can and just drop on the box, right? So thereby I'm manipulating what's going on in the individual. And if I'm not mistaken, what current research is more promoting is that the skill is more likely to improve when you are applying this this focus of jump as high as you can, rather than focusing on, I have to extend my knee and ankle and hip now at the same time. This is more, I think, overloading and confusing for some people.
I love it. Like, this is actually like just what I was also going to say, that a typical thing that you sometimes hear in competitions in fencing is the coach telling the fencer exactly what to do. Oh, the guy is taking this lower parry, so do this to feint his hand, and then he will take the other parry, and then you turn around and you attack his body. And the fencer is only going to focus on this thing. And you can see it so obviously that then a good fencer will just play with him. Okay, yeah, I will show the hand. Yeah, come here, take it, and play with him. Instead of, for example, like you just said, like focus, for example, on hitting his chest, or focus on like feeling a rhythm, or focus on keeping distance, disturb his blade. And then the guy gets to do it in his own way. Even if the fencer would fail, then still the person gets through trial and error, find his or her own solution. And then, like, based on, this is exactly what nonlinear pedagogy is also about. It's like a learning curve. Like, you are constantly guiding the learner through forward instead of telling them what to do. And they don't even realize why they have to do it.
Yeah, yeah. So you're rather, or what you are not, what you're not are is this authoritative, strict teacher telling you just do A and then B and then C and then D, but more like, hey, I'm going to nudge you in this and that direction, and then you're going to figure it out yourself type of way.
Exactly. And if you notice that, fencer, for example, tries the same thing over and over and over again, then it's obvious that the fencer is limited in this certain behavior, in this certain way of thinking. And one way or another, you need to change this. And this is the hardest part when they are in adrenaline and they are not thinking clearly, or they don't feel the game. They are not in this flow. This is still something that I actually try to figure out. Like, what do you do in a situation like that? Because that happens in competitions. In training, you can always, I hate this, and go to the side and take a mental break if you don't feel like it. But how do you do in a competition, really, when this happens?
You can't really say stop, right?
No, exactly. It's like, either you need to find a way how to change this behavior immediately, or you need to avoid it altogether, like avoid it from even happening. This is spontaneously how I would react if I see a fencer doing this. But point of focus, I believe, as an intrinsic, and what you also said, extrinsic and intrinsic focus is definitely one way to manipulate as a organismic or individual constraint to promote performance enhancement. Because like you said, you just say, jump as high as possible. They had from track and field in hurdle run, an example in current CLA, constraint-led approach literature, that they just, there was one hurdle runner who had problem with the technique, always a bit sloppy, but they put like above each hurdle, like a bar or like a target to try to reach with your hand even. And it was just high enough that you didn't really reach it, but then the hurdle runner was automatically doing it with the correct technique. And it's the same, like you say, you create this right point of focus and the learning will happen naturally. And it's about utilizing this natural mechanics of motor learning that reside in each and every one of us as dynamical systems that you create this true learning, in my opinion.
Yeah, so it's really about manipulating whatever you have and facilitate the environment for your coachee or for your athlete or whoever it is that you're working with, can even be a patient, for them to figure it out themselves. But you have to create like a certain space, a certain environment for them to be able to do it in that sense. Like you said, in this hurdle jump example, they gave the target. So now he knows I need to shoot here with my heel, and thereby the technique automatically improved and went to where it was supposed to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they were even just thinking, oh, I tried to reach the bar like that was high above them, above the hurdle. Yeah. And then they even coach. It's like afterwards, hey, did you even notice? Now you did it correctly. Oh, did I? Like afterwards, yeah. Like it's incredible. And like, this is, to put it really simply, this is, as I see my job through my PhD, prove a model for any fencing coach to, because it's hard to know what am I supposed to manipulate. That was a manipulation of intrinsic focus to or extrinsic focus, and also a manipulation of the environment. And how to do it? That's the hardest task, and that's what I see that my first article is about. Build my own CLA model for with a strong theoretical base to support that. If you manipulate any of these constraints, if these are the present constraints of fencing, if you manipulate, you find your method of manipulating them, but you know that if you manipulate this, it's going to create a change in behavior is going to improve performance.
I see. So you are basically providing a toolbox with a gazillion of different scenarios and giving people the chance to select between, I don't know, environment manipulation task, or task manipulation or whatsoever, and
individual,
this therefore you will give a little bit of an horizon. If you manipulate this, this might go into this change of behavior or into this different movement solution or attacking solution or whatsoever. Does that make sense?
Exactly, like to put it really simply. Exactly.
if you, by all means, if you wanted to go more specific into it, now is your chance. Then put the real terminology in.
Well,
into it.
You want me? If you want, I can already give like one exercise.
Please. Let's go. Let's go ahead.
Idea of fencing. For example, if you want someone to improve like their in fencing, like sometimes you need to do small movements with the point in order to be more accurate and, for example, hit small targets like the hand or the foot. And sometimes you need to do like bigger movements to take the blade, for example, engage and hit the blade away and be fast with blade work. So how do we do this? Like one way is to fight with a weapon that is heavier. For example, you put like this like a garden hose where you water the plants in your garden. You cut a piece of that and put it on the weapon, so it becomes a bit heavier, and then it forces you to only do small movements. You can't do anything big because it's too heavy. So then it forces you to only do small movements with your point. And then it's the opposite if you want to make someone faster with blade work. We'll try to give a blade that is shorter, for example, of different length. Then you can practice freely as fast as possible with blade work, or just a blade that is a bit lighter. And then when you notice that the behavior is the desired one with this change, then you check if it's representing itself in the actual context. You take the thing away, and then you see if the motorical behavior has changed to the actual one.
This is
a simple method without telling, because what I have heard so many times, there are coaches who say, use smaller movements with the point. How are you able to do it when you are super tired?
Why don't you run faster? Run faster now.
Exactly. Or like, be faster with blade work. Like, you need to do it like this. You need to use your wrist like in this specific behavior to be faster. No, this is like natural, and you are observing how it changes their behavior. Yeah. And it's one of the exercises I have already included as an example in my article.
Yeah,
it's a manipulation of equipment as a task constraint, because we have the equipment.
So on that note, because you also brought up this example of the shorter blade, like what I also like, the another scenario for me that just came to my mind, and by all means, not a fencing guy, so bear with me. But if somebody, for example, was having problems like actually following through in his attacks, so say they never really fully extend the elbow and their shoulder and go into full protraction, internal rotation to reach as far as possible, that could be also a task, right? To say, okay, we're gonna deduct the length of the blade by 20 centimeters. So now you will have to goddamn fully extend and reach out in order to make that attack and make that move before you then go back and let them do it. As opposed to saying, hey, fully extend your elbow at all times and go into internal rotation and protection of your scapula. Like, nobody can freaking work with that, right? I don't know if it's a crappy example, but this is just something else that came into my mind.
It's already an idea of this creative and non-linear way of thinking, like trying to think of different approaches how to improve a certain behavior. And like, it's also a good idea. Actually, the first thing that came to my mind when you mentioned this, that you want to get a full extension of the body, is to have someone with a rope or something at the end of the tip of your fencing arm when you practice lunges. And every time you do it, you are pulling a little bit during the extension.
Interesting. So let me raise you this point, because now we're talking all about non-linear stuff. There's still the linear. And I think to some degree, it might also be necessary. And I give you another example of a personal training client of mine. We've been practicing handstands. We've been practicing handstands, and we were really focusing on, hey, this is the proper alignment, and have your shoulders above your wrists, and this is what you do with your T-spine, go into full extension, bring your feet together, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. So all those like really important technical details that you kind of must master in order to hold a proper handstand and get into that position. But then we were in this session, and the problem was that when he was trying to swing up against the wall and hold that handstand, he just couldn't do it for some reason. And we talked over and over about those technical elements again, and he was so in his head saying, I need to get my shoulders closer and closer. And then I made a cut and say, okay, let's take a breath, visualize this thing of being up against that wall on your hands. You've done it before, and just take that feeling. You want it. So he took 10 seconds, and he swung up, and then he was there at the wall. So then it was perfect to use this constraints-led approach and manipulate the task a bit, rather than saying, okay, focus more on your shoulders and do whatever, right? And now I'm coming to my point. I think it is still sometimes necessary to teach people certain basics before they are ready for this maybe more chaotic constraints-led approach. What is your take on that?
My take that if you think about it, that's also in one way, that's the hardest thing to define really, because linear in one way is also non-linear, because of course, if it works for you, don't fix it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
So of course, if you are an individual who is very fixed on certain steps and needs to realize how things work in order to be able to execute it properly, then you divide it through sequential learning naturally. And sometimes if you notice, of course, that really there's a certain technique that doesn't work, then you of course have to check it out and repeat it. And it's like you say, also too much chaotic behavior is of course bad. There's even research showing that too much variation doesn't create harmony. And not to become too philosophical, but this is like even backed up by the chaos theory. Yeah. Like chaos delves forth creation, but too much chaos destroys. So you can't really have like too chaotic. Of course, you need to harness the chaos into some form of harmony in the dynamic encircling chaos surrounding harmony in order to create something stable. Yeah. So it's a combination of both, really. But there's so far, but also if there's only harmony, nothing is going to happen.
Exactly. So this because then you have like no reason to adapt and learn something new, right? You have to be put out of your comfort zone or however you want to call it. But
so that's basically, yeah.
What you're saying.
I was just going to say, yeah, like that's my answer, really. Like just to, of course, you need some form of stability. And that's the linear part, naturally. Mm-hmm. If you notice that the person doesn't have any clue what to do and is nervous or something.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your response. It's yeah, I mean, I think we could ramble on for another 4 hours about this. What your answer is reminding me of, because you said you have to get some kind of harmony in, is this concept of desirable difficulty. So it suggests that the optimal learning environment challenges the practitioner appropriate to their current skill level without overloading them. So and I think this is really where arts meet science, where you as the coach have the responsibility to challenge the person that you're working with at the appropriate level. Like,
yes,
create the appropriate level of chaos, create the appropriate level of changes in the environment or whatsoever that is tough for them, that is hard for them, but where it's actually possible for them to find a solution to the riddle.
Exactly. Which is also in one way individual based learning.
True. And here we bring it all together.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. This is this has been nice, and it's really it was just a really small introduction. I feel like I said, there's so much more to talk about. We haven't even gotten to contextual interference yet, but I gotta get going and coach a client soon. So I think it would be a nice time now to kind of wrap it up. Gunnar, first of all, I would really like to thank you for taking the time out and present us with your knowledge and also give us an insight into your discipline of fencing. And also, please, if you have any last words, maybe there's something unspoken about theory that we haven't gotten to yet. So use that time to bring it all out. And in the last step, also, people who want to reach out, let them know where they can find you.
Yeah, to put it really briefly, like this is also... science is supposed to be objective, but it's also in one way subjective in regards to the scientist making the theories. So this is naturally my interpretation of what nonlinear pedagogy is and how to apply it to practice through a CLA model with representative learning design. Another coach or a scientist could interpret it completely different and still be able to prove it theoretically correct. And in order to reach me, I have my Instagram account, tukittaja93. I know that didn't make any sense. Perhaps it's better to just say go and check Gunnar Gräsbäck in Facebook. That works as well. Or just if you happen to be in the neighborhood of Leverkusen and you see someone who speaks like a Finnish person in English, maybe you can take your chances and just say, hey, are you this fencing nerd who I can ask anything that I want?
Awesome. Gunnar, but I suggest you just send me your Instagram profile and I will copy paste it into the show notes of the episode so that people can click it and just reach out directly to you if they are not based in Leverkusen looking out for Finnish people doing some fencing stuff. Awesome, man. Gunnar,
exactly.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate
it. Thank you too. Thank you for all the listeners that made it through to this point. I know we've gotten quite geeky towards the end. So thank you also for your time. And I hope to hear you again soon. Until then, train smart and move well.